Welcome to Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the weekly podcast. President Obama took a predictably globalist, interventionist theme in his recent speech for West Point's graduation. The president talked about steering the currents of history and said, American leadership also requires us to see the world as it should be, and he spoke about us having to affirm international norms. But everything that U.S. foreign policy touches in the world turns toxic. The huge Russian-Chinese natural gas deal, it's evidence that the attempt to isolate Russia over Crimea has backfired. In Iraq, the casualties from a growing Sunni uprising and the entrenchment of Al-Qaeda affiliates amounts to hundreds a day. Casualties of hundreds a day. Things are spiraling out of control in Libya as well. The Benghazi region is a hotbed of escalating violence thanks to rival militias. In May, Obama positioned a standby force of 200 Marines in Sicily for a possible mission in Libya. And then, speaking of international norms, as the president did, anybody who looks for norms or consistency in U.S. foreign policy or a clear underlying principle is bound to be seriously disappointed. And that is nowhere better illustrated, Dr. Paul, than in the U.S. posture about recent elections around the world.
Boy, that's for sure. You'd think that they're almost doing this on purpose. You can't believe that their brain would tell them to do all these things. So maybe they're feeding into the theories of the conspiracy people. They must have an ulterior motive to be blundering such. And of course, we could be a bit facetious and say, well, you know, if Obama's messed up, I guess what we need are the Republicans back. Maybe the Republican neoconservative radicals can straighten this mess out. But the whole point is that the inconsistency, the mess in foreign policy is a result of a bipartisan agreement that's been going on for a long, long time of intervention overseas and a belief in a principle of American exceptionalism. This is the big problem that leaders of our country for many decades now, if not even longer, that we've come to the belief that there's something very, very special about us. And it's not that that shouldn't be considered, but not the kind of exceptionalism they're talking about. And this drives our leaders into doing these dumb things and being so inconsistent. Now, we who are looking at this foreign policy where they'll endorse and support one election, but not the other one, and vice versa, depends on who wins and this sort of thing. If you look at it from the whole idea of, say, pragmatism and utilitarianism, inconsistency isn't the problem. You just, you know, try to fool the people long enough, and then you just pick and choose. So they're consistently wrong in what they do in being arbitrary, but they don't get too worried about inconsistency. But one thing I've found out over the many years, especially in the last several years, talking to a lot of young people, there seems to be something naturally attractive about being consistent, even when the consistency seems to carry a penalty with it. But at least people want the truth and upfront and not have something that you can't trust. But like you were talking about some of the recent votes, I mean, it's just astounding. There was, just a vote in Syria. And even our CIA, Hayden, had said a while ago that if there's an election in Syria, Assad's going to win. Of course, we were working very, very hard to throw him out, and that has failed. And that war is essentially over. The killing isn't over because we're still involved in giving money to those individuals that were trying to throw Assad out. But Assad has an election, and we condemn it, and our Secretary of State, Kerry, says, oh, it's horrible, it's a zero for him, and it's condemned. I mean, there was an election in Ukraine just recently. Poroshenko won, but he's the guy that was behind and was on the side of the people who used a coup to throw out an elected government. Well, throwing out the elected government was good, but putting in elected government is even better because it's the right guy. At the same time, they say, well, when the election doesn't go the way the Americans want it to go, oh, they didn't allow the right people to vote. Well, it just turns out that the people in eastern Ukraine didn't have the same opportunity to vote as those who were in western Ukraine. Of course, there was a referendum and a vote, which under circumstances, probably not perfect, but compared to all the other elections, not too bad. And that was the vote in Crimea. And the large majority, wanted to stay away from being in combination with Western Ukraine. And it doesn't seem to be such a stretch. It wasn't tanks and power and threats that did this, and even money. It just turns out that Crimea used to be part of Russia, and they speak Russian. So it's not a tremendous leap to believe that election. But of course, our government condemned that. Same thing in Egypt. You know, we propped up a dictator there for decades, gave him tens of billions of dollars, and that was Mubarak. Then the people got restless and we got nervous. So then we helped the Muslim Brotherhood to win an election, and Morsi wins the election. But then he overdid it. He was more extreme than they had hoped. So we decided we don't like him anymore. So then we go and support the military again, and the military overthrows them. That to us is okay. Now, they just had another election, pseudo-election at least, and now we're very happy with it. So it's very, very arbitrary, and it's such a shame, because I have to admit that when Obama was running, he said some things about being less interventionist opposed to the war and closing down war, and you could argue there's less Americans dying in Iraq and Afghanistan, but policies have not changed. He's a big interventionist, big internationalist, in meddling in these affairs, has an iron in the fires of all these countries. We're not really leaving Afghanistan. And believe me, if push comes to shove in Iraq, we'll be back there too, because we have the largest embassy in the world still in Iraq, and a lot of killing going on there. So if it gets more disruptive, I'm sure that we will not hesitate to go back in there. The only thing that will save us from getting more bogged down and more Americans getting killed and precipitating even a more worldwide type of conflict will be the fact that we'll go broke before they're able to do it. And I've always argued that we probably won't come to our senses either on the welfare state or the warfare state as long as people accept our dollar. And as long as we can print the money and run up the debt and pretend that we can police the world and give unlimited welfare here at home, we're going to do it because of the political pressures. But I see the end is coming. It's not so easy to do this anymore. I think the world's getting nervous about it. I think this is a big deal, the fact that the Russians now have a 30-year contract for $400 billion with the Chinese, and more companies in Russia are starting to use the renminbi as a currency instead of the dollar. So things are changing. There will be a blowback from this, an economic blowback, and that's what we're starting to see. But just this whole idea of that speech confirms the fact the most important thing to come of this is that Obama, he has not given us a new foreign policy. He's changed the rhetoric a little bit and the tone a little bit to try to appease some of the people on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But there's no less intervention now than there was before. We still live in a very dangerous world.
It's even more dangerous because Americans have no idea what their government is doing. As you like to say, Dr. Paul, it wants to know everything about what the people are doing, but we're not allowed to know anything about what it is doing. For example, the failure to get to the bottom of the running sore of Benghazi is only because Republicans care only about asking questions that give them some sort of partisan advantage over Democrats or Hillary Clinton. But because this is a bipartisan foreign policy of the governing classes, nobody really wants to get the story behind the story of anything like Benghazi, because, of course, both parties have their fingerprints all over these policies.
You know, I think that's a perfect example of it, because, we orchestrated and we were dropping bombs and we were part of NATO, but NATO's really us. It's our weapons. And we, precipitate that uprising. And you're right to point out Benghazi's a big deal, but it's a political deal. The question is why were we involved in the overthrow of the government? Why were we bombing people? Why were we in Benghazi if there was a war breaking out and there was civil strife there? I think a wise government would remove American personnel and say, hey, look, there's a war going on here. We don't want anybody killed. It's not our war. It's not our fight. Of course, then we have to remind everybody Could it be that we had an interest because I think Libya has some oil over there, and that just might be playing a role in this. And unfortunately, oil has played a big role in the entire Middle East for a long, long time.
Well, I find that very hard to believe because in the lead up to Bush's elective war in the Middle East, the governing classes and the war cheerleaders assured us so many times that it had nothing whatsoever to do with oil that I just assumed there was not so much as a drop anywhere to be found in the region.
Yeah, that is the way they'd like to portray it. But if you look at the countries that literally have lost a million lives in Africa and different places, didn't have oil, not much has happened. And the countries that we do get involved in, Nigeria and other countries, you know, they will move, you know, those countries will have oil. So, yes, it's still a little bit of mercantilism that exists in this country, believing that if we don't have control of the supplies, we'll never get it, not realizing that even, and we don't have to decide which faction, because there will always be local factions deciding who's going to own and control the resources, but eventually they have to sell them. And the world is big enough, and it's broad enough, and the markets are big enough that there will be competition. I remember clearly, you know, when the price of oil hit $40 a barrel under Jimmy Carter, everybody thought it was going to go to $100. But, you know, and then there was some deregulation under Reagan, and oil went down to $10. And they kept saying, well, OPEC's going to have a meeting this month, and they're going to fix the price of oil. And as if, you know, OPEC is significant, wasn't they? Control a lot of oil. But, you know, they couldn't do it. There was enough competition. There was always somebody in OPEC that cheated. And so the market, there's powerful forces in a marketplace. But this whole idea that we're driven to have these wars with control of natural resources. Now, I think it's a shame that I have to sort of defend China a little bit because most people know where China was a few years back. But China, you know, with the money they save and the hard work that they do, they have an influence. I think it might be important to have an influence on where the natural resources are coming. But they do it a little bit differently, almost more attuned to what the West claims they are. You know, they make money, they save money, and then they invest it like a capitalist. And they go and make deals with Iran and other countries like that. So it's ironic that when we deal with natural resources, we're the more the mercantilists, and we send our troops over and try to control natural resources. And those communists, whom we had to fight, you know, for a good many years, cold wars and hot wars, they're acting more like the capitalists.
Well, I'm afraid we've exhausted our time, but thank you once again, Dr. Paul, for another great conversation and podcast. And thank you for joining us for the weekly podcast. I'm Charles Goyette.